Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Dr. Mitch, welcome back.
Pleasure to be back.
I want to remind everyone listening that you can get your questions answered by sending an email to 420research@gmail.com, and we may bring it up again on one of our bi-monthly segments here on the Marijuana Agenda. Also, you can always call our 24-hour message line at 650-LEGAL-MJ. That's 650-534-2565. And wow, Dr. Mitch, there is a whole passel of studies that came out all on top of each other, it seems, and we got a lot to get to. So let's start with this first one, a study showing that the medical marijuana programs that have been established throughout the United States haven't led to more increased marijuana use by youth. We've heard that before, but what else is this study telling us?
Well, what's curious is we're seeing higher rates of adult use if the medical marijuana program isn't necessarily tightly regulated, but not more cannabis use disorder. And so I want to emphasize that what this really means is, sure, more folks can get their hands on cannabis, but that doesn't mean cannabis is somehow creating more problems. And I do want to point out that cannabis use disorder now has a range of severity, so literally just two minor symptoms and you can actually qualify for the disorder itself. So the idea that we need these tightly regulated medical programs that only allow, you know, people who are near death or dying to have access, that's really not the answer to our problem here, and that we could have plenty of folks have their symptoms alleviated and even have adults be free to use recreationally without creating problems.
Does this report then suggest that the loosely regulated medical cannabis programs are somewhat standing in a bit for the lack of adult use regulations?
I got to admit, it's easy to sort of read it that way. So some folks who may come in with something that's a genuine symptom, but not something that you think of as a severe illness, say insomnia, they're going to have access now in a way that is comparable to folks who might not bother getting a medical card in a state where both medical and recreational is available, or in states where it's really all just recreational and folks who go in for medical reasons or otherwise can also have access.
In this next study, the title threw me off when I saw it. It says, "Is access to medical marijuana a disamenity?" I had to go get my dictionary to figure out what that was. But according to what I read in it, it said something about medical marijuana laws causing families to flee or raise fewer children in the states that pass these laws. Have you ever heard of anything like this?
So it's curious because that whole idea of a disamenity, something that would discourage people with children from living in a state, is not one we hear about in the news too often. And when you take a look at the abstract here, you'd think, oh, wow, people who have kids must not want to live in a medical marijuana state, which seems a little counter to some of our readings of, say, the children with epilepsy who really can benefit from cannabis-based meds. But this is one of the most abstruse articles we've had in a while, and I had to go all the way down to one of the tables in the abstract here, and what you see is 3 years later, there's a drop of 12 families per 1,000 with kids. So we're talking about a really small effect here, and not one that I'm absolutely sure can be attributed just to medical cannabis. I think there may be things that are in common in some of these states that had data analyzed that had medical marijuana availability that might have had folks who either aren't necessarily interested in having kids be more likely to stay there, or just plain old job opportunities for families may have been different in other states and folks may have left for those very same reasons.
You know, I'm glad you bring that up because one of the first things I thought of when I read this was, this is with respect to legal, adult use marijuana, but in Denver, Seattle, and Portland, these three cities where legalization has taken root, the rents have just skyrocketed and there's been a real shortage of available housing. And I would think if you're a family looking to live somewhere and the rents are going up because of legal weed, perhaps that has something to do with it.
I really find that explanation a lot more parsimonious than some oddball phobia of medical marijuana. Nicely put.
Wow. I'm working toward my honorary doctorate. Let's get to this next study. Examining the influence of adolescent marijuana use on adult intelligence. This is the go-to talking point. The Project Sam people want to say, you know, if you smoke pot when you're an adolescent, you lose 6 points of IQ. This claims to have further evidence in the causation versus spuriousness debate. What new do we get from this one?
Well, so we've got this national longitudinal study of adolescent to adult health. So get folks at 12 to 21 and then follow them up years later when they're 18 to 26. The hope being we'll find some predictors of change in a number of measures, including some of the IQ measures. And unfortunately, this is a lot of smoke but no fire. The significant effect that they're making a big deal about is really a 1 to 2 point change in intelligence scores. So that's, you know, basically the kind of thing that you might have a problem, or maybe you just needed to pee when you were doing that test or something like that. I mean, literally a broken light bulb could create a larger change in IQ score here. And so it is statistically significant simply because these sample sizes are just huge. And that's only for the binary measure, have you ever used or not. We're not seeing an effect where as use increases, IQ goes down in a stepwise fashion. And that's what you'd really expect if cannabis were altering IQ. So I got to say, you know, yes, cannabis isn't for kids and you're not going to go to school high and learn anything. But this notion that it's going to create some kind of wild brain damage and lower your IQ to some kind of mental retardation is absolute nonsense.
Another study comes up in our list having to do with anxiety, and it's entitled The Effects of Acute and Repeated Cannabinoid Injections on Immediate and Delayed Object Memory and Unconditioned Anxiety. We know a lot of people that use cannabis to treat their own anxiety. Is this study going to bolster that case or harm it?
This is another one of those wild three-way interactions where high doses the first time might work, but only for female rats. And then they seem to habituate on the second dose, but not in the males. And so I gotta say, this is one of those predicaments where this is adding to a big body of literature, but this study on its own isn't particularly definitive. What I would emphasize is that we are seeing during intoxication some problems with encoding of memory, specifically in the younger rats, and the female rats may be at higher risk for this, and that at least in a high dose, THC by itself, what a surprise if you're a rodent, makes you kind of high-strung at least the first time you've done it. I feel like the real meta message here is if you've got clinical anxiety, medical cannabis probably isn't your first line of defense. Feel free to email me for a referral to a nice mental health professional in your area. And then once you treat that anxiety, you'll be able to enjoy your cannabis a whole lot more.
You know, we've discussed in the past the use of cannabis as an analgesic and some studies that showed some moderate use helped, but then if you went too far, you went over the line and it made things worse. Could that effect be at play here with respect to anxiety?
It looks like it's a little more linear rather than that inverted U we saw with pain, where there's a nice sort of Goldilocks sweet spot there. With cannabis, the higher the dose, the higher the anxiety seems to work, at least in these studies where THC is administered on its own. I do feel like the strains that are popular out there often have enough CBD to take that sort of magical ideation, psychotic, teeth-grinding edge off some of those sativas. So it's not going to be the same for every single strain, but the evidence we have for just THC on its own, it looks like the more you get, the more psychotomimetic, as they say, or anxiety-producing it can become.
You know, I was at the Portland Hemp Fest Expo this weekend and heard a speaker discussing how he wouldn't even select a cannabis product that didn't have at least 1% CBD in the profile. And it's nice that we have legalization happening and we can get these numbers and kind of shape our decisions based on something other than the THC percentage. Is that something that you've heard of or would recommend?
Oh, I would definitely recommend that. We do find in sort of the underground work that the high CBD strains are much less likely to be anxiogenic, you know, generating anxiety. And, you know, I really envy anybody in those states where they have those data. Here in New York, it's such a small medical program, and not quite the same level of sophistication in the reports. So folks are going in without that knowledge about CBD, and then we're discovering more and more about CBD on its own being wonderful just as a neuroprotectant and just an amazing medication. So I'm hoping that real high CBD strains will become part of every dispensary's armament.
And, you know, speaking of anxiety, there was a piece in the Chicago Tribune saying smoke weed to relax, you may want to reconsider. This was a study out of UIC. Is this the same study, or was this a different look at the information?
No, this is a delightful lab that actually my student Nicholas Van Damme worked with this same crew years ago. And the bottom line on this is just we've got an anxiety-producing procedure in the lab that requires going up and making a speech in front of cameras and trained graduate raters who are sort of looking at you in this foreboding fashion while you're doing this public speaking, which is something that everybody finds really aversive. And it's not stunning to learn that a high dose of THC prior to this kind of public speaking event is not particularly pleasant, particularly in an experienced user. So you and I might really get a kick out of this, Russ. But your average UIC undergrad who gets approved for a study like this, of course, is going to say that the THC is making things more stressful when they have to give a public announcement. But the headline then is a little misleading. So this saying, smoke weed to relax, what I would have liked to have seen is, after this horrible speech, could people have access to THC and then relax? And I think that would have had a lot more external validity.
All right, one final study for us to take a look at, the examination of cumulative effects of early adolescent depression on cannabis and alcohol use disorder in late adolescence in a community-based cohort. Basically, we're trying to find out, if you were depressed as a young teen, does that lead to cannabis or alcohol disorders as an older teen? Is that the gist?
In fact, that's really the direction that seemed to pan out, and the reverse was not true, which kind of does buttress our argument that essentially the disorder is not stemming from cannabis use, and cannabis use doesn't seem to be generating depression. It's that folks who are depressed do the best they can, and a subset of them turn to cannabis in hopes of getting some relief and may actually get some, but particularly early in life when you don't have a lot of the skills required to just handle things, you are more likely to get diagnosed with a cannabis use disorder. But as I mentioned at the beginning of the segment, cannabis use disorder now is literally just two symptoms and not something to confuse with, say, heroin dependence or some of the opiate dependencies that we're seeing so much in the news.
Always informative to have you here on the show. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is a professor at SUNY Albany and also the host of Burning Issues, a podcast on CannabisRadio.com, where he goes into more depth on some of these burning issues. And can you give us a preview of your next episode?
We should have Normal's new executive director on there real soon, and he's going to give us the lowdown on what's going on federally and some of the state legislation as well.
Fantastic. Dr. Mitch Earlywine, thanks for joining us here on the Marijuana Agenda, and have yourself a great day.
You too, man.